Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Jack Bedell, author of Color All Maps New, published by Mercer University Press in 2021.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today, we're drinking a Bayou Mudslide inspired by Jack's poetry collection. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make one and have it with us.
For those not familiar with Jack Bedell's work, Jack Bedell is professor of English and coordinator of creative writing at Southeastern Louisiana University, where he also edits Louisiana Literature and directs the Louisiana Literature Press. His work has appeared in the Southern Review, Radar Poetry, The Fourth River, Terrain.org, Construction, Grist, Sugarhouse, Shenandoah, and more. Bedell is the recipient of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities Individual Achievement in the Humanities Award and the Governor's Award for Artistic Achievement. He was appointed by Governor John Bel Edwards to serve as Louisiana Poet Laureate from 2017 to 2019.
This book marks Jack's 13th collection of poetry, and in it, he explores reparation and loss as he writes about family and place. This collection contains poems that are personal, ecological, cultural, and fantastic, at the same time promising new maps to navigate damaged territories. In Color All Maps New, Jack offers revision and restoration, light, and hope.
Wow, tall order, right? How are you feeling today, Jack?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, today we are looking forward to talking with you about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Is giving live reading something you enjoy?
I'm a fairly nervous person in public, so I don't enjoy it the most out of everything in my life. But, you know, I really like connecting with people and being able to show them the rhythms of the poems and tell the stories. Mm-hmm. And my favorite part of the reading, giving readings actually, is just telling stories in between reading poems. That's my favorite part because I get to yabber and I don't have to worry about staying on track or any or anything. So that's what I really enjoy.
Can you tell us about the poems in your upcoming book? How you put them together, how they connect, how you chose to divide the sections?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I was coming off a book where I was asking a lot of questions in No Brother the Storm, things I was concerned with, coastal loss, and a lot of environmental issues caused by the storms that we'd suffered in the last decade or so. And at the same time, I was trying to grapple with a lot of that. I lost my mother suddenly. And then at the end of the collection, I lost my father. Mm-hmm. And those poems typically lean into questioning and searching and trying to find answers and solutions. And in a way, I felt like I needed to write some poems that verified or offered solutions or really leaned hard into the belief that these solutions are there, that hope is there, and it's not something we have to search for. It's around us everywhere. And so the poems in Color All Maps New are really trying to offer, even when they're looking at some dark things or some problems in our society or in our avocations or in our families, they're trying to recognize the fact that no matter how dark it is, there's light somewhere and it's there for us. We don't have to search it out. It's ready for us. And I think that's the difference in character between these poems in Color All Maps New and the poems in No Brother the Storm. I tried to organize the poems in each section around kind of the Pace Rabbit poems that are called lines poems. So, you know, like for instance, one of the sections begins that I'll read today begins with the poem Lines for Johnny Wilkinson, who's a person and a rugby player I really admire. And that poem kind of encapsulates a lot of the character and a lot of the concerns of the poems that follow it in that section. So each section of the book is built around a poem where I'm talking about a family member, or I'm talking about a sports figure that I enjoy, or a historical figure, or a writer that I enjoy, or a musician that I admire. And those poems allow me to get some of the themes out.
Interesting. Yeah, I've read your other collection, the one No Brother the Storm, and this one, and I love both of them. This one, I definitely sense a lot more light in it.
It was time for that. It was definitely time in my career to stop asking a lot of questions, which I had never really done in my poems. I'd always tried to have answers before I started writing a poem. But these poems, I tried to limit the number of times that I left the poem going, well, I hope you find an answer to this.
Well, I have a two-part question for you next. Thank you for that really detailed discussion of that. It's always so helpful. We love giving other authors, especially new authors listening to the podcast, ideas about how artists and authors create and keep creating. So that's one of my big focuses, something I'm interested in. I have a two-part question for you. The first one is, did you always imagine you'd be a poet? And the second part is, what for you informs your decision toward making not just a series of new poems, but deciding it's going to be a collection?
The business of being a poet never occurred to me until I was nearly finished with school. I took a creative writing class my final semester at Northwestern State in Natchitoches just because it was at the perfect time in the day and I needed 3 more hours of English. And I was handed a book of poems by the teacher. It's R.S. Gwynne's book, The Drive-In. And it was the first time I'd read any contemporary poetry because I'd only read the poems taught to me. And throughout my life, I'd only been taught romantic poets like Coleridge and Wordsworth and Blake. And I thought that's what poems were. And the poems I was trying to write in the creative writing class were all kind of Blake on the Bayou poems where I was trying to age in Coleridge. And luckily, I had a teacher pull me out in the hall and say, look, man, everything you're doing bad. And the people you're trying to be have been dead. So I appreciated his honesty so much, you know, to tell me that you're bad, but you don't have to stay that way. I can tell there's something in the way you're grappling with these things that you can turn, but read this and then come back and talk. And I spent the weekend reading Gwynne's book and I realized, and Gwynne, I got to say, is a formalist. I mean, he looks like he writes informal poems with rhyme and meter that really were not out of the world, the same world that I was coming from. So I was able to engage on that level. But the fact that he's writing about barbecuing and throwing ball with his dad and pranks in the neighborhood, it clicked. And I said, you know, my whole life I've loved telling stories. And my family is a storytelling family. We're a bunch of porch sitters. And everybody has always valued that in my extended family. So I didn't have anything valuable or philosophical to say, but I had a ton of barbecue stories and a ton of ball stories and a ton of family stories. And from the moment I read that Gwynne book, I decided this is what I'm going to do. And I've done it every day since then. So thankfully, I had that teacher pull me out in the hall and tell me how awful things were going or I wouldn't be here. And the issue of when I know a collection, I think I've always tried to focus as I'm writing on ideas and themes, whether those themes be the notion of control or whether those themes be, like in the last book, environmental issues coupled, which really morphed into a, not just loss of coastline, but loss of family and what it means to who I think I am, that my mom and dad are gone and that places where my brother and I hung out as kids are now open water. They're not land anymore. They're not there. And so they're only memories. And all of that merged together. So even if it's something like that, I chew at those ideas and those subjects and all the poems until I feel like I've built a well-rounded, kind of non-redundant collection of poems. And then I do my best to move on to try to morph it somehow for the next collection. I don't like writing outside of an idea like that, because then if I don't know the context of the poem, I feel obligated to put it all in or to answer all the questions in 24 lines. It's so difficult to do that. If I know I'm in the context of a collection, I know whatever I leave undone, I have a chance to do again in another poem. That's how I build it.
Great. Thank you.
You just said something and I want to go a little deeper with it. One of my favorite poems, and I just tweeted about it, is called Couplets Interstitial. And it reminds me of my dad and all the stories that he used to tell. Along with telling stories themselves, a lot of your poems are about storytelling. And you just mentioned something about that, but I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit more about the connection of storytelling to who you are personally, whether it's part of your personality, whether it's part of living in the South, your family. Where does this come from for you?
Well, I definitely think it comes from being born in South Louisiana and raised around a bunch of people that as soon as you pop a top or as soon as you spill the food out on the table, the stories start flying. But I really value the joy that a story brings. And I think it's probably, if I really focus on my fondest memories and the things that I feel like I can go to when I'm hurting or I can go to when I when I'm worried, all those events that I go back to are based around gathering and storytelling and sharing humor and sharing lessons, because that's how I was taught everything I know. It was through story. It wasn't through textbooks, or it wasn't through someone sitting me down and saying, okay, son, this is how you cast a net. You know, it was about watching it being done while a story was being told, and those things intertwine for me. I can't separate them. I know that in my heart, it's kind of like that. There's a Shapiro quote, and I can't remember whether it was Alan Shapiro or Carl Shapiro, but it's one of the poets, Shapiro, who said that narrative arises with the realization that we are bearers of history. And I've lived with that since I read it. And I think that's what my poems are able to do. I carry history, and I carry the value of those memories and those stories and those people with me. And I'm able to kind of archive them in poems for others and for myself in really in ways that are valuable.
Yeah.
I really love the idea of archiving memories in poetry.
I love that too. And I love the idea. I just read this interesting article. I don't even know where it came from. It was about Eskimo culture, I believe. And it was talking about the use of oral tradition storytelling to in parenting. Like the parents aren't allowed to, it's very childlike, or it's very embarrassing to yell at your child or to be angry. And so it's kind of an interesting strategy they use to not be angry people raising children who become angry people. So I love how, you know, culture and things work differently, but essentially the oral tradition is so important, especially in the South too. So I really felt that about your work too. Those may not be exactly connected, but in my mind, they were kind of connected. I'm like, wow, that's really neat. People in the South are doing this storytelling all the time. And then also these Eskimos, no, or people around the world, of course. I want to ask a question. I really love the poem Silkies, which is about the chicken and the foxes. I just got really attracted to this poem. But it was so universal, because it's really about how the human who tries to save the chickens from the foxes, because more and more of the chickens keep getting hunted, or not hunted, but eaten, needs to keep adjusting the pen for their safety until going to this extreme, somewhat extreme measure of digging a moat in one of the last iterations of the efforts of the human in the poem. And the last four lines in particular just grabbed me so much. Mud will dry on the shovel where I hang it. And I'll lie awake feeling foxes circle the fortress I've built, their frustration spread out across the ground like fog. So beautiful. How did this poem come to you? When?
Thank you for that. I have a really good friend, Clay Mixon, who's a Hammond resident, and he is constantly trying to find some new exotic moment for his life. And he ordered a batch on eBay of silky. And he lives out near Tickfall.
Yeah.
That is kind of a conflation. That poem is kind of a conflation of all the things that he struggled with trying just to raise these six chickens, with the foxes doing their best to climb his fence and get in the top or wedge their way in the hole. And what it meant to me, it was just a perfect analog for problems. No matter what we do to guard those things that are precious to us, there's something intelligent and scheming trying to get at them. And we can do our best, but in the end, we're trapped in another room somewhere hoping it all turns out okay and hoping that our scheming works, our counter scheming works. And in that poem, I was really trying to give equal time to the fox and the beauty of that too, that it wasn't more or less admitting that all problems aren't bad and evil things, that sometimes it's our own urges to get rid of problems that are the evil things. And that poem is really a poem that lent itself to me. It's based in real life where these events happen, but I think without having to stretch for metaphor or invent any of that, it carries so much for me. It's a perfect example of how a story carries.
Yeah, for sure. A word for me that rises up when I read these poems is the idea of things being transitory. Like the poem, Gulf Waves, when your daughter's trying to write names in the sand before the water can wash them away. And I know that coastal erosion is an issue that's near to your heart. And I wanted to know if you would talk to us a little bit more about that.
And that's something I wouldn't have cared about 15 years ago when everything that I cared, you know, everything in my mind, the things I loved the most, it was all there. It was available. It was intact. And then it just seemed like everything took a bad turn and I became, and I don't know, I'd read in books about how much coastline Terrebonne Parish was losing daily. And I'd read the studies and I'd seen the maps losing their color and turning to water and all of those things. But you know, until I experienced my brother, I think I've told you the story before, Ram, but my brother texted me a photo of open water. And I asked him what the heck he was sending me that for. And he said, that's the point. That's the point where we used to take a left to go to the back marsh.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, 15 years ago, a landmass, and it's open water now. And then my folks passed away. And, you know, so basically this notion of how change occurs and loss occurs and we can fixate on it and see it as emptiness, or and like I'm trying to do in these poems, or we can see it as just change, that the beauty's there, it's just different. Whatever we love about our coastline, it's there, it's just changing in front of us, and we can do what we can to mitigate it, but in the end we're going to be left with the choice to love what we have. And both in life with our families and in the environment. And that's what I'm trying to get at in this notion of change. At some point, I'm going to be faced with the choice of having to decide or celebrate the value of what's there in front of me, not what I remember used to be there or not what I think, you know, where it's headed, but what's there in front of me. And just in my own life, I'm always going to choose to find the most beauty I can in the moment where I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And gosh, that's so beautiful to hear you talk about that. And I loved hearing you say the color disappearing from the maps, not because of that happening, but because it really informs the title of the book for me. Things You're Thinking About, Color All Maps New, right? So that's actually a regenerative idea that you brought to an extremely important visible place with the title. Can you talk about your work titling the book?
It's such kind of a thankless task to find titles for individual pieces or to find titles for whole collections that I've almost given up trying to invent titles. I just try to find that moment in one of the poems where I've struck the core of what all of these poems are about. And that line, when it appears in Nuage, that poem gets right at the notion I'm trying to draw in these poems, that we have this map. We have a choice. We can choose to celebrate the color it is now, the color all maps new like that, not just cartography, but also in our own life and the way we map our minds. So that was just a line that I think strikes to the core of what all these poems are trying to do. And that's my tactic now for naming every collection I'm ever going to write. If I'm blessed with more collections in the future, I find the line that gets to the point and use it.
That's a great idea. I can't even imagine coming up with the titles that a poet must have to come up with, because just writing a short story or a novel draft and having to come up with a title for that is hard enough. So when you're writing multiple poems and collections, it seems like it would be a challenge.
You're either too literal and you're not contributing anything to the poem, or you force some abstraction. I'd love to be a visual artist. They can just walk up on something and say, I'm going to call that number 9. So that's what I would love to do. Just that poem's number 114.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I have a fine artist friend who's an abstract artist, and it's completely abstract. There's absolutely no figure in any of the paintings whatsoever, but he names them the most divine things, like existential contemplation of the world in black or something, you know, like, and you're just like, what is happening here? But it's so fun and it's so, so cool. I want to talk about another one of your poems. I find that the poem Lines for a Country Song Best If Used Before, the two introductory tercets, I mean, I've read this poem like 3 times because I keep sitting here thinking, trying to find my way into the thought process of the older gentleman at the bar who gives advice to the poem's narrator. And the advice is, son, when your mind goes to thinking about changing, don't change, quit. What does this advice say to you? Maybe you could speak to it for a moment, because I'd be really curious to hear kind of how this narrative story came about with these two characters in the poem.
The literal story is that I was on Maple Street, chin to the bar, after a long day of clear liquids, your vodkas and your gins and other things. And I was thinking about switching to bourbon. An old dude that kind of lived at the end of the bar, because he was there every time I was ever in the bar, said the first thing he'd ever said to me and ever did say to me, which was, son, if you're thinking about changing, don't change, quit. And as sage advice from a man that knows his way around a bar, I had to take his advice and belly up. And I think when you tie that into that poem, which is kind of about a relationship that's not going as well as it could, or that's actually left the dock, then I think it does have the tenor of a country song about the dog's dead in the yard and the woman's taken off with the mailman. And the, you know, and so I was really kind of playing on that theme. I was trying to riff on that a little bit, the idea of down and out in a honky tonk kind of.
I like it. You've talked a little bit about this in some of your other answers, but I want to go to it a little bit more with storytelling, with coastal erosion. You've sort of circled around what I'm interested in, the sense and the importance of place and how Louisiana features in your poetry, how it shaped you as a poet, as a person.
Yeah, I can't think of myself as anything other than a Louisianan, and I don't know how or when I'll ever tell someone I'm from Hammond. I've lived here now 27 years, and when people ask me that question, I always say Houma. I always say Bayou Cane, actually, because that's where people from Houma know I'm from Bayou Cane. They not actually didn't live in Houma. So I would say that the place itself informs everything I am and everything I care about and value. And it's not just a matter of my people having been raised there. It's something I'm truly proud of. I'm extraordinarily proud of Nicholls State University. I only went there 1 year, my senior year of high school, but it is the place where they keep the future in Terrebonne Parish. And I respect it and I idolize it as an institution. And I'm the same way with the people like my uncle, Ray Rougeau, who lived his life on the water and who earned his living from the water. I idolize people who continue to do that and keep that alive. And I think I'm paying the tribute I can pay by being as accurate as I am, as I can possibly be to those things and to that place. And with the notion of erosion and coastal, you know, loss of wetland, the place, the things I value most about it, it's not the dirt and it's not the reeds. It's something else. And a lot of my poetry is just trying to find that something else that I can carry no matter what happens to the silt or what happens to the wetlands. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we got the best minds. The best minds that Terrebonne and Lafourche have ever produced are working on coastal restoration in and around Nicholls State and in and around the State Department's resources. And they'll get it fixed. If it's fixable, they'll get it to a point where we can enjoy it and generations can enjoy it. So I have faith in those guys. And I think my poems as tributes are trying to pay some of that faith forward and also trying to just recognize that the efforts are being made to not just salvage stuff, but to create for the future.
Yeah, I definitely get the sense of that when I read them.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that poem. I don't know if you pronounce it Prosh. It's with the blue herons. I love that piece and how it evokes like this kind of thread of people in it too. So much is going on like that. And the water is so prominent in your work, Jack. I really loved that part about it too. So I want to ask you something. Who are your favorite poets, male and female, past or present, and why?
That list grows so much every day. I've been threatened so many times with a ban on credit cards and a ban. You know, I had this really bad, awkward stretch where books came every day for 2 weeks. And my wife, Beth,
wonderful stretch.
She was homicidal. I mean, she lived with it through 10 days of straight books showing up. But then the last 4 days of straight books, I mean, I was constantly twitching, waiting for the butter knife to make its way into my heart. So I really enjoy discovering poets and people who are, you know, doing exciting things. I mean, right now I'm reading, and I've been on this kick for the past several years, but I'm I read as much Joan Kane as I can, who's an Inuit writer from Alaska. Her poems are very sparse, but intelligent in ways that I can't reach toward. And so I learn from them every time. I'm a big fan historically of James Dickey. I learned what a narrative poem is from reading his poems. Same with Wendell Berry. I learned tone from reading Wendell Berry's poems. He has such a flat, almost a reverential tone toward his material that I've tried to learn throughout my career. And then, you know, every day I come across Alina Stefanescu, who's a poet from Birmingham. Her work is just mind-blowingly extraordinary. The beauty of social media to me is that I have links, hundreds of links coming at me every day on Twitter by poets I truly admire, and I'm clicking them all and I'm reading it all. And it just creates this massive kind of flood of poetry. I just put a book down on the floor 10 seconds ago by Kelly Tedescu, who's a kind of a really extraordinary Gothic writer, writes a lot of fantasy horror poems, and her technique, her use of space, incredible. So I fixate on individual writers like that, and I immerse myself in their work as best I can. And then I find two more and then four more. And that's the beauty of poetry, is it's not static. People, you know, bag on creative writing programs as being a kind of imitation factories. And I don't think they are. I think that having come through a very competitive MFA program at Arkansas, none of us write alike and none of us are similar. We're similar in our drive and we're similar in our ambitions, maybe, but we're not similar in how we execute things. And I think that the more I read, the more I'm just knocked out by people's choices. And the extraordinary diversity of the choices they're making it's incredible. The energy I get off that, it makes me at first feel like I'll never write another poem because I can't do that. And then I immediately go write another poem because I have to try.
Yeah, know that one.
Yeah, I get a lot of my recommendations from Twitter too. It's really a wonderful place for that.
Yeah, I sometimes think my role on Twitter is just to retweet other people with emojis on top of it, like eyeballs.
You're great at it, though. You retweet people a lot. You also retweet journals that you read a lot and respect. And so you're a great resource.
It's got to be aggravating to everybody that I show up in their feed because I'm always going, hey, guys, look at this.
I like when you tweet for my afternoon friends and you'll retweet something for the morning.
I love it. No, I actually love that because I feel like then authors are curating my feed. Like, here's something really great. Not the crap you thought you were going to see when you arrived at the... No.
Right.
So right. It feels a special blessing when writers are curating my feed, actually.
I agree. So Jack, tell us a little bit about your experience as Louisiana's Poet Laureate, which was from 2017 to 2019.
Great question, Rand.
I know that what I consider my role in Louisiana in terms of trying to find ways of getting other people's voices amplified or trying to produce programming either through Louisiana literature and the publishing opportunities that we offer to poets, not just in Louisiana, everywhere, but particularly I'm fond of Louisiana poetry, but the workshops I do, like literacy programs in schools, all those things were dear to me because it was what I could do to make the state stronger, to make it better, to make it smarter. And so the work of the Poet Laureate is just on a larger scale than all that. And so I didn't see it as an honor at all when the governor chose me. I just saw it as my time to pick up the ball and go to work. It was my duty. I got to do all these great things on a statewide scale and not just on a local scale that I care deeply about. And so it was a tremendous honor, obviously. But it was also a great opportunity to just get to work and to shine some light on all of the wonderful voices we have in Louisiana. Because I mean, we're blessed. I mean, we're blessed with fiction writers too and storytellers. But the diversity of our poets, and you know, not just those who have stayed here, but the poets who have gone off to do wonderful things, that hasn't stopped because people have left to go teach at Emory or left to go teach at USC. I mean, we're growing more and more, and I found that out as Poet Laureate. Real privilege is to be able to go into a fourth grade class in Bastrop and be confronted with 18 wonderful storytelling poets. in a grade school class and know that we're going to do okay, that these folks, I mean, the voices that we're growing here in Louisiana are going to continue to explode on the scene and to be integral to society. So that was the beauty of being Poet Laureate, is to be able to get the opportunity to continue doing the work that I value on a statewide scale and to have the advocacy of the Louisiana Endowment of Humanities and the Governor's Office and all of these resources to really help these communities out. You know, thinking the funding opportunities, if they bring the Poet Laureate in, a library can receive $1,200 or $1,000 in funding for a program. So it doesn't matter if it's my dog that's the Poet Laureate. The library gets the $1,200 from the state. And that's the beauty. I think that's the beauty of this programming. It's not to celebrate the poet whose turn it is to do this work, but to celebrate the people who need the resources and who are doing the real work of putting this programming together to help our communities. Because I've said this before multiple times to Rand, but that we're at a time in our history where more than anything, people need to have confidence in their voice. Because we see a lot of garbage going on in the world, and we all need to be able to speak freely, strongly, and clearly about what we feel is right. And the more people who are confident doing that, the better off we'll be. And that's what poetry offers to young students, particularly, a chance to exercise their voice and to really be loud, clear, and proud about it. And to have a sense of accomplishment having said a thing. That's poetry affords that opportunity every time you put a pen to paper. And the Poet Laureate creates opportunities like that in communities that would not normally get them. So it was a great privilege for me to be able to do that. And, you know, I would do it again in a heartbeat. If John Warner Smith got strep throat or something and they needed to fill in, I've already told them, man, I'm there. Just shoot me a text. I'm there, because that stuff's important. And it's really the best tactic we have to make sure generation after generation in our state can speak clearly and proudly and effectively, use their own voice.
What great energy and intention to bring to that role. Really what?
Yeah, definitely. All right, with my next question, I'm going to take this from macro, you know, statewide to micro, to your space as a professor in the classroom, as an individual. As a writer, as editor of Louisiana literature, as professor, as mentor, as a man, how do these different roles inform the space you take up in the world, your identity, your acts, in the smaller scope, in the day-to-day? And what is something important for you to teach in almost every poetry workshop? Like, if you could only teach two things to every student in your poetry workshop, what would they be?
That's a tough question, because I don't usually limit myself to the way I teach is kind of would be, have you ever been in Mardi Gras parade and seen one of the guys on the second story of the float dump a box of That's my approach to teaching, is I just drop a big box of rubber balls out onto the street. And then hope some of it is entertaining. But yeah, I know this. I know that the notion of writing is important to me. Don't think about writing. Don't plan your writing. You know, all that's good stuff, but you got to write. And you know, you have to get out there, that don't be afraid of bad writing. That's one of the messages of the New Orleans Writing Marathon, is give yourself permission to write poorly. That this notion that if you put it down in the wrong wording or syntax, that you somehow besmirched an idea, or you've ruined your chance to ever express something beautifully, that's garbage. You can ruin a poem. Look at Leda in the Swan by Yeats. Yeats's poem, that's considered what? The best sonnet of the 20th century. I've read a whole book of bad drafts of that poem. That guy went through 60 something drafts of that poem, and they were trash until the last one that he stuck with. And how he had the fortitude to know, to even recognize it by the time he hit it. So, you know, be courageous enough to just put it on paper. We can deal with it later. That's a revision. That's a different part of the process. Compose, get it down. So that would probably be my first piece of advice I'd have to bring into a classroom. Get it down.
Yeah.
Put it on paper.
That's great advice.
And then secondly, it would be a matter of confidence to realize that there are any number of ways of publishing something, and that just putting it out in the world is making it public. So don't be afraid to share your stuff out loud with people. Don't think that one form of publication is more prestigious than another. Just because you can't get something bound, flat spined in a journal that comes from Iowa, it doesn't mean that saying it at a local open mic isn't valuable enough. So
right.
Get in front of people and make sure that you don't hoard your writing. You make sure that you find ways of making it public, because that's how it helps the community. That's how it helps others. And it's not just a selfish thing, that writing art, like Carter said, or art is not self-expression. It's communication. So that would probably be the second thing. Get it out in the world. Get it down, get it out in the world.
Wow. That's a great message. I love it. Well, we are so looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Color All Maps New today. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
I always feel a little bit like I'm a commercial right here. Today's booktail cocktail is a Bayou Mudslide, and the recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 1 ounce vodka, 1 ounce Kahlua coffee liqueur, 1 ounce Bailey's, 1 shot of espresso, and 1 ounce of cream. So you shake everything but the espresso, pour it in a glass with some ice, and add your shot of espresso. That's the drink.
Awesome. It's very tasty. I'm having mine right now. For Jack, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the poems you're sharing today?
I'm going to read some poems from section 4 of the book today. And these poems are really about times where I came across something that befuddled me. You know, watching something happen in my own life or reading something said by someone I admire and just being blindsided by how different in character it is from what I would have thought, even if it's a historical event like the Last Island Storm that reading about really befuddled me. And so these are poems where I'm trying to relate to people and events like that.
Fantastic. We're totally ready. Take us away.
This first poem is called Lines for Johnny Wilkinson, who's an English rugby player who I really admire as a human being. He works hard. He's an underdog. He's someone who's made something of himself just through hard work. And so I kind of gravitate toward people like that. And the poem starts off with a quote from him, actually, that spurred the poem on. Lines for Johnny Wilkinson. I don't know what it is, but my frustration is so intense. I start shouting at the wall, screaming obscenities. I punish myself for my mistakes, too. When my left foot lets me down, I stamp down hard on it. At one stage, I'm so livid that before I know it, I'm sinking my teeth into my own hand, trying to bite right through the skin between my thumb and index finger. Is there something in the pain that gets you closer to acceptance, closer to allowing yourself missed goals or overthrown passes? Maybe it's a balanced ledger of debt and recompense. I often catch frisson over memories of my shortfalls. Times I could have done something to help my mother set our Sunday table, or could have told someone I cared about how perfectly the light framed their face, or made even a single step toward someone else's needs. Would settling those debts on the spot with real hurt have saved these shivers later? Would actually biting my own tongue right then help me live with all the unspoken words? Every lost chance to put comfort in someone else's day? No matter how much we do in this world, there's always more could have or should have left to echo. It never matters how much blood you draw biting down on your hand, how many marks you leave stomping on your kicking foot. The shadow of perfection is dark, and taking the next kick is our only light. This next poem is called Beignets. I want to show my daughter how much her grandmother loved making beignet dough. Such simple work. Metal bowl, warm water, yeast and sugar, eggs, milk, and salt, quick whisk and cups of sifted flour. My daughter's hands, shaped so much like mother's, would be perfect for kneading, for making smooth this dough as sticky as any memory. Was in Antioch Gallery during one of the New Orleans marathons and came across a dollhouse in the back of the gallery. It was just fascinating how really detailed the house was. It was such a miniature, perfect little house. I got really close to it, and then I noticed out of the corner of my eye that the price of the thing was like $15,000. It's like took six steps back quickly, and I realized, and then it hit me what it was with some perspective. It was part of Chris Antio's series called Murder Houses, where she recreates the houses of these serial killer crime scenes. And then I started, once I saw what it was, I started looking at the house closely and realized it was full of skeletons and saws and crazy things. And that's where this poem comes from. It's called The Gacy Murder House. And it really is just from being confounded with something that seems so pristine. And you step back two steps and you realize it's this horrible thing. So it's called The Gacy Murder House. Why is it so easy to admire this dollhouse hidden in the corner of the gallery? Its room so tidy, well lit, pinked with flowers, ginghamed in patterns, molding in frames as white allows. Is it the respect that its artist had for the spaces that make such places homey? Its tasteful furnishings? The neatness of design allowing us to overlook skeletons lining the crawl space beneath its floorboards? Portraits of killers, clown masks, saws, drills, duct tape, bottles of rubbing alcohol, so conveniently idle with purpose? This next poem is Last Island, 1856. They had no dreams to guide them through the screaming winds, no sense of what the waves meant bounding onto shore like baying hounds at the base of an oak, only Reverend McAllister and a carousel on the levee to lash onto for the night. How like the end of time that storm must have felt. How unhinged the island spinning around them. The ferry from Bayou Buff broken and run aground just yards away. Its captain fishing bodies out of the surf. The next poem is Prayer Does Not Have To. Prayer does not have to whisper with reverence while clouds thicken to purple in the sky. It can percolate, chortle, and climb like Coltrane's horn in A Love Supreme, probing in fits and squawks, clearing a path upwards, then knocking over all stones until there is no right of way, no safe passage, nothing but timpani and bass, drowning all hope and distance. I've been in that room where it's clear the storm is on its way, where light diminishes its chord until harmonies fall off each other, breathless. Let the thunder have its say. Open a door to the sizzling wind. Trust the score to give each note space, each need voice, until the whole room vibrates in half tones, raises itself into the sky. This loud song can find a stable key. This kind of noise can beg light down with a cymbal's roll. It's a poem about my son, or my oldest son, Jack, who I've struggled my whole life to teach not to be like his old man, but he has the weirdest tendencies to do annoying things like me. He's always been very anticipatory, looking ahead, wondering what's going to come of the future. And this poem hit me as an irony because it was from an event where he was a quarterback in high school, and so was I, and I was trying to teach him how to throw into space. And that's where this poem comes from. Space, release. I'm teaching my son to throw into space. He sees motion and color, releases the ball toward what's no longer there, always behind his target, no matter how soon he releases the throw. His feet pat grass in rhythm, motion and delivery all good. His eyes, though, won't drift beyond now. Strange to know how much the future presses on his heart. 14 years old and so looking forward to drink or girls or driving, so ready to haul off toward the open arms the horizon extends just out of view. And yet, how miserable hard it is to help him accept the notion of early. I'd like to finish with another poem about a great day I had with my daughter. It's called Summer Botany Lesson. No matter how many blossoms I point out exploding overhead on our neighborhood walk, my daughter isn't buying it. She's in love with the sound of bougainvillea, thinks the word's so pretty, there's no way it stands for something real. She believes I made it up, strung long vowels and kissy soft consonants on a strand of rhythm to make her giggle. I wish I could tell a story that would win her faith, but learn to let it lie. Some truths beg for a fight. Some would rather echo on branches in crooked light while you just walk off holding hands.
Thank you so much. That was really, really wonderful. I know I've told you this before, Jack, but I especially like your poems about your family. And I think I would like them even if I didn't know them and haven't met your family in person, and they're so lovely, everyone. But there's something just that resonates for me with them. So I'm really glad you finished off with that last poem.
Thanks for
having me. Yeah, so lovely. Thank you so much. It's such an honor to have such amazing writers on this series. And thanks so much for your reading, Jack. So great to hear your voice bringing this work to life. Can you tell us a little bit more about your anticipated next projects for the next 12 months? Just kind of give the listeners a little bit of what comes next for you.
Sure. I've been blessed recently to be able to, you know, be given the opportunity to have books out and to have poems published. And the next year or so is going to be pretty exciting for me, and really, you know, more than I deserve. But I've got this book, Color All Map, coming out in February from Mercer. And I just signed a contract for another collection that'll come out a year later from Mercer, Against the Woods, Dark Trunks. And this February, again, I've got a chapbook of Cones based around lines from hardcore rock songs.
That's
Rock Garden. And it's a series of kind of meditations on some of my favorite lines for some of the heavy music that I listen to. It's a little out of character with these poems, but it was fun to write. And I'm looking forward to that coming out from Daily Drunk Press in February. I've got plans to keep writing and keep working on projects. I'm getting really close to finishing a book of poems that are really out of character for me, because they're all ghost stories. That comes out, you know, year after next, if I can get it together well enough. So it's been fun writing all these poems. I missed the summer with the New Orleans Writing Marathon, and that set me back a little bit, because I was always able to get a dozen, you know, get headway on a dozen poems writing with that group. But we'll catch that back up next summer once we get this virus under wraps.
Yeah, definitely. Those are all sound like really exciting things. I can't wait for them. So I have one last question. You sort of talked about it, but in a separate way, for beginning writers, people who would like to write poetry, not necessarily students or not necessarily people who can take a poetry workshop, what would you say to people who want to start writing poetry for new writers?
Well, some of that has to do with goals. If your goal is to just write because you really feel like you have things you need to say, then my advice would be, don't worry about anybody else. Don't worry about what anyone else is doing. Don't worry about rightness and wrongness or appropriateness or any of that. Just grab a notebook, grab your favorite writing instrument, and go sit somewhere that is conducive to writing and write it down. If they're not interested in getting into the business of publishing,
yeah,
then just go do it. Just go write it down. I don't care about it. Get it together. And probably if it's valuable to you, it'll be valuable to the world whenever you're ready to send it out into the world. But if someone really wants to get into the publishing side of things as it's going on right now, then I always send them toward poets. I don't send them toward publications. Find writers whose voice or whose technique or whose vibe is in line with what it is that's in your heart or what it is you're trying to do. And then look at their track record. Look at where they're putting their poems out into the world and go follow their trail. Don't be a trail setter. Go follow the trail. They've done the hard work of setting the pace for you. Now go catch them.
Excellent. Excellent advice. Well, I think that's it. Thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really enjoy talking to you and hearing you read from your work.
Yes. And everybody, please go order Jack's book, Color All Maps New, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the book tales, readings, and drinks for this podcast series. Subscribe to the podcast too, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.